Yeah, good to see you all again this morning. As we start, shall we have a word of prayer? A good God, on this beautiful morning, once again, we pause to thank you. Thank you for this world in which we live, for the beauty of it, for the gift of life that you have given to us, and, of course, for the gift of your Son, Jesus Christ. Draw us closer to him, we pray, as we study your word. May it be strong in our hearts and may it guide our lives. For we pray in Christ's name. Amen. I don't know about you, but it seems like the weeks go so quickly. I have a feeling that has something to do with that word I don't want to use. So I won't. You can guess. But in any case, Sunday ends and all of a sudden it's Sunday morning again, which is just amazing to me. It seems like that continues to get quicker and quicker. Luckily, oftentimes there are good things in between, so that helps. You have known, or I know some of you are here for the first time today, we have been dealing with Matthew, and the title I've given to it is Living in God's Coming Kingdom. And we've had two sessions already. The first one talking about Jesus and the sense of embracing him as Messiah, ultimately. That's the main, absolutely main theme in Matthew. But then the second session following out of that, Messiah of what? The Messiah, the King, ultimately related to the kingdom that is coming. And the coming kingdom, as I put it in the title. The kingdom of God, which, as we were saying last time, comes in principle, in a sense, or in seed, or foretaste of it into this world, but the fullness of it is not here yet. So that's that concept of already and not yet that I had mentioned last time. So as you see, because of the blue highlighting there, our session this time, the third one, is on following Jesus. The stress there, in one sense, is on the word following. Obviously, it is Jesus as Messiah, so that fits with everything we've been saying. But this really is a very strong concept in Matthew, and we'll see a little bit more about that later. But if you think back to the Sea of Galilee, when Jesus goes around early at the beginning of his ministry, he sees Peter, sees Andrew, he sees James and John, and what are the words that he says to them? Follow me and I will make you fishers of men, or I will make you to fish for people, is the way the modern translations like to put it, for obvious reasons, but it kind of loses that ditty flavor when you don't say fishers of men, right? Some of you probably could sing that right now, but I'm not going to ask you to. I'm certainly not going to. But that's the concept. Follow me. And this comes out in Matthew a lot, and it's related to the another word that's a little more technical, you might say, or more specific, but not quite as a living. A few years ago, the presbytery, when they were doing one of their restructurings, took the Christian Ed person, basically, but that area within the presbytery concerns, and they renamed it discipleship. Really a broader term, right, in a sense. It suggests more living into and more activity than Christian education can sound like a cerebral thing. And oftentimes it is, and certainly that's an important component. But it's what you do with the education, what you do with the learning, that is really what life is all about. So they started to use that term. It was kind of popular everywhere. It's been around for a long time, obviously. And like every word that we Presbyterians come up with for a big theme, we use that for a while and then we move on to something else, which becomes the big theme. And over your lifetime, you see a lot of those when you stop to think about it. Again, it's a little bit like you find in the news cycle these days. Something comes up, it becomes the center. And after a while, after everybody's concentrated on it for a long time or some period of time, then the next thing happens, and that's what you concentrate on. That's in this case, discipleship was almost a buzzword, I guess is what I want to say. But it's got a really deep meaning to it. And ultimately, under the surface, that's what this third session is about, discipleship. I wanted to have it in a more active word, however, and term, and one that comes from Matthew, and that's then why we're talking about following. Well, before we actually go much further, there's one thing else to note, and that is that following Jesus, we can just say off the top, is going to be hard. Not really easy. It's going to be hard because the kingdom, as we were saying last time, is not here yet in fullness. There are problems. And the big problem is the problem that in philosophical language is just called the problem of evil, right? Well, it appears strongly, that concept of evil, in Matthew. And this is one of the really significant places. This is from the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 through 7 in Matthew. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Did we not cast out demons in your name? Did we not do many deeds of power in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you evildoers. You find that term, evildoers, at least four times in Matthew. It doesn't really appear as often in the other Gospels. It's a strong theme in Matthew, under the surface of his talking about the kingdom coming. All you have to do, obviously, is look at the news to see how this kind of thing comes out, right? The people doing marvelous things, being leaders, seemingly having it all together, and then something goes wrong. Then you find that the feet are certainly of clay, and maybe more. Most recently here, obviously, in the last 2 weeks, our representative, Tim Murphy. I mean, what a shock. It happens to politicians a lot, obviously, riding high and then falling a long distance. But it's true in business, not just politics. It's true of sports stars, as we see and hear about regularly. And getting closer to home, it's true of evangelists, which you sometimes see on TV, and also ministers and leaders in churches. It's something that nobody can avoid because evil is so strong in this world. Undoubtedly, there are different reasons in every single case in terms of the personality, the psychology that's going on. But it also fits, doesn't it, with that sense that power corrupts? Something about power draws us in when we have it, and it makes us somehow, many, feel somehow bigger or more than otherwise. That's why I suppose, reading sports pages, for example, when you learn that a certain great star athlete is a very humble person, isn't that just refreshing to read? Not to say that all of them are prideful otherwise, but the fact that that's dwelt on for a moment instead of all the things that go wrong. It's just it just feels good to hear that sort of thing. Well, as I said, Matthew knows about evil, and he's concerned that we all understand it. And as a result, early on, as I had alluded to last time, we get evil shown in its fullness. Because here's Herod, just after Christ's birth, and here's what we learn, that when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated, since they didn't come back and tell him how he could go, where to go to worship the baby Jesus. And what did he do? He killed all the children in and around Bethlehem, not just in Bethlehem. kind of as we pictured, but in the region of Bethlehem, who were 2 years old or younger. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. Rachel being a representative of Israel in that picture that Jeremiah, the prophet, is using. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they were no more. Matthew wants us to see how deep-reaching evil can be. That this person, Herod, who's a greatly powerful person, and as I stop to think about it, now wait a minute, Herod's getting on in life. If this is a baby born now, what's the threat? It's going to be a long time before that baby is old enough even to be a threat, and Herod's likely going to be long gone anyway. You could say, well, he wanted his children to inherit the throne, but the Romans decided that anyway. It wasn't really his choice. And besides, he killed a couple of his own sons earlier just to be sure that, because they were old enough to maybe revolt, he got rid of them along with his favorite wife, who he didn't trust. He loved her, we're told, and showed it in a rather remarkable way. But when he gets rid of his own sons, it's really quite understandable. But it's not as though he really cares so much about his own family and a family line. It's all about Herod, only about Herod. And so even why he's too worried here is somewhat surprising, but it shows you how deep going it is, in fact. He's not even thinking about it. He's just thinking any threat gets eliminated, period, regardless of whether there's really any serious danger here or not. Well, Matthew shows us that right away, and then he moves us, as soon as Jesus is baptized, moving into his ministry, to the temptations, where Jesus is sent by the Spirit out into the wilderness, tempted three times, as you will remember. And the thing about that, Matthew basically is telling us that evil is an ever-present threat. It's going to show up at all times. And if even Jesus can be threatened by evil, think about it. If even Jesus can be threatened, we're in mortal danger, aren't we? Evil surrounds us in ways that are very open and obvious. And that, of course, is what we read about in the newspaper. But in all kinds of other ways, too. And those are the ones most of us need to be on the lookout for. That's why the Lord's Prayer has that prayer, doesn't it? Lead us not into, but deliver us from evil. Yeah. Yeah. And again, as I said, this is not in a sense surprising to us. Just think of all the terrible things that happen in society that are evil in a broad scale. There's Las Vegas very recently, Somalia, Myanmar. We sort of read about Syria in the Middle East continues. Just look on TV, the most exciting things to watch are thriller movies where there's an evil man or woman sometimes who is threatening everybody around them. Detective shows are really popular. Front pages of newspapers, obviously, and all the rest of our news. Somehow we're also attracted to it. It's a whole strange sort of thing. That's the dark backdrop, in other words, to the kingdom and the coming of the kingdom and why it is in so many ways so difficult. That's all I want to say about that in itself. But notice just two other kind of sub-points, you might say. And one is that there is this concept that we talk about these days, structural evil. It is not really clearly present in Matthew as such, and not in lots of the Old Testament. It's not discussed certainly in the way we might discuss it. But notice this passage from the Old Testament in the laws of Israel in Leviticus. But if there are not sufficient means to recover, and they're talking about property that someone has to sell to someone else because they can't afford to to keep it at the time. They've fallen into poverty. What was sold shall remain with the purchaser until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released, and the property shall be returned. If you read Leviticus 25 and try to make sense of all of this, it's a really complex discussion of what is to be done in what circumstances and on and on and on. But the basic idea is that if somebody in Israel is in need and in trouble, they might borrow more money, or they might actually sell property or sell themselves into a kind of indentured servitude to another Israelite for this period of time. But at the end of Jubilee, 7 years, or the big Jubilee, which this one is talking about, 50 years, 7 times 7, and then the following year, at that time, all of these things are to be brought back to their original state so that you don't end up with society where those who have end up, you know, the 1% that we talk about these days, and everybody else down here in suffering. That there should be some kind of equalization of things so that it is there is more equity for folks. In other words, structural evil is what it's talking about. The basic idea that evil permeates society, not just individuals. And when that is the case, it's not just individuals doing evil deeds, like Herod just mentioned, but it's really the whole arrangement of political and social institutions that can create issues that are unjust for the general society. And they can have bad effects, obviously, for the more vulnerable in society. Now, obviously, as you know, if you've heard people talk about structural evil, the other side of that is, or at least another part of that is, those who have the power to change it aren't exactly inclined to change it. It tends to be the case that things are going well, so why change it? Why not strengthen it, if anything? That's certainly true today. And that's not what I want to stress or talk about in detail, but it's certainly got to be noticed underlying the sense of the kingdom and the kinds of things that Jesus says in the rest of Matthew. But it's so certainly true not only today but at other times in history that scholars are almost certain that this law in Leviticus, in the Old Testament, when Israel is expected to keep the laws, was probably never followed. Somehow it got overlooked in the mix. Well, you can talk then about structural, but you can also talk about evil in ourselves, and that's where we get to a lot of what is said, because certainly in Jesus' time, there was very little chance to change structure very much. And this famous passage that you all know, again from the Sermon on the Mount, "Do not judge so that you may not be judged. For with the judgment you make, you will be judged, and the measure you give is the measure you will get. Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye?" We all have heard that many times, haven't we? Do not judge. Look for our own flaws before we start talking about other people and theirs. But, you know, here's a question for you. Why is it that judging is so tempting for us? What is it about it? We feel better.
They're less normal.
Okay, it puts us on a higher level, right? Because we can talk down to them. Yeah? Yeah, so if that's the case, then one big thing is missing there. Right? And this happens to be, in a sense, the starting point for what Matthew is talking about as he talks about following Jesus. Ultimately, it's all about humility. Not putting ourselves on a higher plane, but being humble. So, at that time, the disciples came to Jesus and they asked, "Who's the greatest?" We're not the only ones to want to be up there on the podium or a pedestal. Who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? I mean, that's a pretty big... Would you have the nerve to say that to Jesus if you were one of the disciples? I think I might think it and wonder and, you know, kind of wish it were me or something, but to say it? Sometimes these guys don't have their heads screwed on straight, you might say. Who's the greatest? So what's Jesus do? He calls a child whom he put among them and he said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children yourselves, you will never enter the kingdom at all," basically is what he's saying. "Whoever becomes humble like his children is the greatest. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes," notice that, "me." There's a subtle underpinning, too, of how you treat others. We'll talk about that more next week, actually, in the final session. But at this point, it's the childlike humility that is an issue here. Well, we all know little children are cute, right? That's kind of a foregone conclusion. I was out biking with my two young grandchildren yesterday. Our families were out, 7 and 4 and a half, and they're just so cute. I mean, they're the cutest grandchildren everywhere but where yours are. And but see, they're so open, you know, and at one point, difficult, but they're straightforward about it when they're difficult. Yeah, there's just this openness, there's this friendliness, and all of that. But that changes, obviously, over time with children. However, children were not thought about that way to the same degree in this time period, actually. Children were primarily seen as a nuisance. Well, maybe the mothers didn't think that. But the fathers and the older children in society felt that way. So children were always kept back. Don't let children be involved in anything and get in the way of significant discussions of whatever it might be. So, you know, actually, if you think about it, this comes in Luke, not in Matthew, but the story of Jesus going to the temple, staying there at the age of 12, and talking, you know, theology with the rabbis while his family has taken off and the family has to come back and find him. There's real shock there that Jesus is in the temple, a child, talking with adults. But it occurs to me that the shock might be greater in the parents' part. You can imagine the rabbis, after they see the kind of the innocence of Jesus, but also the depth of what he can already talk about, that they would be interested. You can imagine that, and very surprised, so shocked on one level, but his own parents, that their son would have the gall, you might say, to stand there in an adult discussion and be talking. Yes, this is Jesus. Yes, he's special. But, well, that for the parents must have been really totally unexpected. Well, Jesus has to tell the disciples this, though, right? That the children are what it's all about. They don't get it. And so it's just in the next chapter, chapter 19, that the children are coming and the disciples say, "Send them away," because they're taken away from the discussion. And Jesus says, "Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them." The old language is, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." That's Old English, and it carries a bad connotation in modern times because it suggests that you're suffering them, putting up with them. But that's not the meaning. The meaning is, let them. And that's how it was understood when King James's people did their translation. Let them come to me. Do not hinder them. Why? Because they show what our primary attitude as a disciple is to be. I can't not tell you about an incident or at least a story related to Karl Barth. I'm not sure how many of you know that name any longer, whether you remember it or have run across it, but just a show of hands real quick. Yeah, at least half of you. Yeah, Karl Barth was a primary theologian in the first half of the last century, and will go down in history, pretty much everybody agrees, as one of the great theologians of all time. Not just the greatest in the 20th century, but in that line of people for centuries and centuries, if you just had to pick out 5, 6, 7, 8, something like that, he would be one of them. Lived in Switzerland, it was Swiss, stood up to Hitler in the war. He was able to stay away from him, so he had a little more safety in doing it. But phenomenal theologian, and he had this impishness about him as well, and humor. Well, the story goes that, and there's some questions about whether it really happened, but there, because the story has been told numbers of ways, numbers of locations. But he came on a speaking tour to the States in 1962, went to a number of the theological schools and universities, and did a tour, so to speak, and was speaking. And some people say that he was asked the question. Other people say somebody asked him to summarize his theology and different things like that. But the question was, can you summarize your theology in a brief sentence? And the response, supposedly, and I'm saying that because I'm just not sure. I heard it was at Princeton, but what I've read to double-check myself was Chicago or Virginia. And, but also that Karl Barth could have set up the question at all these locations, too, just for the fun of it. As I said, he was impish. But his answer, has anybody heard this? His answer? Yeah. His answer, according to this, was, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. It really does summarize his theology. It was all about Jesus. That was the whole Christological in the theological language. It points then to the sense of children once again and the humility that is part of what a child is like. So children and what Matthew is calling us to understand from Jesus' teaching is that humility is the center, and that means that what is not the center? The opposite, right? Which appears continually in the Bible. The danger of pride. Now, it's the issue is pride, not pridefulness. I do want to make a minor little caution here. It's okay to be really proud of something you've accomplished. I had my own professor in Amsterdam, Beckauer was his name. I was at one of my meetings at his house one time in his office, and he pulled out one of his books, his theology books that he had written. It was in Korean. It had just been translated. He was really excited. He was showing this, and look at this. And there was a childlike pride there. It just was all over him. And it's always struck me that that distinction has got to be real clear. There's nothing wrong with feeling really good about something you accomplish, or really good about something somebody else accomplishes. It's when it becomes pride, again, I'm better than others because of whatever it is, that it's an issue. That's when it endangers humility. But pride itself, that concept is all through the Old Testament. It's all through the New Testament. And in the medieval church, as you probably know, there was a discussion and systematizing almost of seven deadly sins. Pride's right in there, of course. In fact, usually it's at the head of the list. And usually the theologian said, it's the root of all the other ones. Sounds a bit like the Garden of Eden, doesn't it? I want to put myself in a higher position than I should. So, humility is the only proper response, the only sensible response, if you think, as we were saying last time, that Christ's kingdom overrules all other kingdoms. If that's what the world ultimately is all about, then that is the case for that means that our only smart attitude is to be humble. Well, for the fun of it, let me add one other little song here from children, since that's where all our wisdom comes from, I believe. The wise man built his house upon the rock. The wise man built his house upon the rock. The wise man built his house upon the rock, and the rain came falling down, right? The rain came down, and the floods came up? Rain came down, and the wise man's house stood firm. I would imagine quite a few of you could also sing that song, right? Some of you probably could do the hand motions. And again, we'll skip that today. But if you just think about that song, where that's teaching children, it sounds so simple, so easy. But where's it come from? It comes straight from the Sermon on the Mount, doesn't it? In fact, it's the summary of the Sermon on the Mount, this that theme. And you see it right at the end of Matthew 7. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like the wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain fell, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on rock. And then the foolish man building on sand. And the whole point of it is those first words. Notice that again. Everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them. These words of mine, in the context, are the Sermon on the Mount. And then everything else Jesus says, obviously by extension. But it's put there as the summary, or the conclusion, you might say, of the Sermon on the Mount itself. Jesus' words, in other words, are authoritative, just like the Old Testament is authoritative. And that ties right into the phrase that I used earlier, doing the problem with the evildoers who do great deeds. What's their problem? They don't do the will of their Father who is in heaven. So altogether, they're doing the will of your Father in heaven and following the words of Jesus. They belong together. Bobby.
Since we're coming up to the time when we start to think about Martin Luther, sometimes want to make that as though all you have to do is believe and that's it. So this is a different thing. So
it is different. Different from the way Luther formulated it. It's the same as the way the book of James formulates it, actually. It's the faith and works thing. If you have faith but no works, what good is it, right? What's happening there, and Paul, of course, is the one from whom Luther gets, you're justified by faith alone. Actually, they're defining faith in two different terms. For Paul, faith is trust. And your full trust is in God or in Christ, and therefore you're trying to do everything that Christ would want you to. So the works are going to flow out of it. Actually, if you read Paul, I'll come back to Luther in just a sec. When you read Paul and are looking for this, he talks about doing things, following Christ's lifestyle, etc., 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 a whole lot more than he ever talks about justification by faith alone. That appears three or four times in a, you know, strong, it's strong, I'm not denying it. But for Paul, works are an automatic thing that flows out of it. You don't talk about them. You don't say, I'm justified by doing, by having faith and then also doing works. You're justified freely by God's grace, period. But the effect of that is, if that's really entered you, you're going to want to do what is God's will. Actually, Luther thought the same, but in that context, in the Middle Ages, when people thought that they, you know, did indeed need to be doing all these things. It become, thanks to the leadership of the church, unfortunately, very legalistic. But it's a normal human trait. What do I need to do to be sure I'm okay, right? That's the problem with legalism all the time. Well, if I just do this, God will be okay with me. Or if I just do this whole long list of things, God will be okay with me. So when you get churches and groups and us at various times thinking, okay, I'm doing this and this and this, so everything's fine. Well, how do you know? And we'll come back actually to that concept. Luther, though, just to conclude that, Luther at one point said, okay, so I just see, this is one of his main works actually, on initially. Okay, now I see that I'm actually justified by faith. I don't need to get down to Rome. I don't need to do all these good deeds. I don't need to climb up the steps, I forget which church in Rome, on my knees 10 times, 20 times, whatever it was, to show that I'm trying to be good. God accepts me as I am. It's faith alone. It's trusting in God alone that is going to save me. So then he said to himself, what will I do? That means I don't have to do a lot of things that I otherwise would be doing to be sure I'm okay. What shall I do with my free time? I will go out and serve others. So it's a matter of how you look to faith. And the language that Jesus is using is more Old Testament at this stage. It's trusting means knowing here and being convinced. But then the work, then you just add the works. You can't just say it. You've got to act on it. So it's almost a less theological way to say it. But it's a more typical way that the Jewish folks thought in that time compared to, say, the way Paul did it. Yes? Well, that's... Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, if you say, we did this, yeah. Then you're again pointing to yourself. Yeah, right. And that's putting you on a pedestal and, yeah, or them on a pedestal. So, yeah, that's, yeah. It's saying, look at me, I'm, you know, what you want. I'm especially deserving. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, this is the really underlying thing that's going on here, and it's going to lead to another word that I want to mention, because this word is an Old Testament word that's used a lot in the Bible, and we don't use it much now because it's got this negative connotation, righteousness, I'm going to say this a little differently. The term itself really means more like setting things right, the right way they ought to be. It's not necessarily even an ethical term. It's a general term that you could use, but it's used in this context to say how you should live. To be living according to God's will, you should be righteous. And the language you get here, Jesus, again in the Sermon on the Mount, at the beginning this time, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. I want to be righteous. But it doesn't mean I want to look really good to my neighbors, right? And you'll see that a little bit later when it says the Pharisees like to go out and pray in public so everybody sees how righteous they are. But you go pray in your closet so nobody sees it except God.
Those who hunger and thirst for justice in the sense of fairness, not in the sense of criminal justice, but some. That's another way to think of it.
Yeah. Well, and that in Greek, it can be the word righteousness can be translated justification or righteousness. So that's where that's coming from. Justification, unfortunately, is a little narrower a term. The word carries a broader connotation that doesn't bring out. That's why righteousness, most translations will stick with. And there is a sense where that's part of it. And then the other piece is, for I tell you, unless your righteousness or justice exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll never enter. Whew, that's scary. That's where it sounds legalistic, right? I got to be better than them? Well, wait a minute. Then in the Sermon on the Mount, it goes on to talk about one of the examples I just used, in fact, the praying in public or giving alms that everybody can see or other things like that, rather than doing what you do naturally out of your inner life. So the point of this really is that it's talking about your inner attitude, internal attitude, your heart, to use that language. Following Jesus doesn't mean you have to be doing in a nice legal arrangement of, you know, the do's and don'ts. It means that you're out of your heart flows the kind of things that lead you to do what is right, what is righteous. And so it's not puritanical, it's not rigid, it's not, again, looking better than others because you're doing all these things and they aren't. And the minute, you know, you find myself thinking, oh, well, at least I'm doing that, that's already wrong. it's already suggesting that I'm a little bit better or something like that. I want to flesh this out a little bit by going back to what we looked at the first time in the first session when we had the rich young ruler up here. A few of you weren't here at that time. I used this initially as an example of how the Gospels work. Mark first was written first. Matthew and Luke used Mark. And in so doing, they adjusted Mark and sometimes varied various things in order to make the points they wanted to for the audiences to whom they were writing. And so, rich young ruler, if you've ever used that language, which is the normal way I suspect all of us have grown up, hearing that as a parable, is not accurate when you realize you have to look at all three Gospels to get that as the name. He's rich, yes. That's agreed upon by everybody. He has great possessions or something like that at the bottom. But Mark has in the middle there, from my youth, he's kept all the commandments. Luke follows that, from my youth, but Matthew says, calls him a young man. Matthew has varied the language about who this person is who comes to Jesus. In each case, however, I'll come back to a little bit of that in a moment. Notice what he's wondering as he comes up to him. He's asking, in Matthew at least, what good deed must I do? Right? He's looking specifically for the thing or things I need to do to be sure I'm in. Just what we're talking about. What's Jesus' almost quick answer to that? Keep the Ten Commandments. He's just given the second set of the commandments. He's not talking about love of God and so forth, that first part, but he talks about the things that relate to how you treat your neighbor. He just gives him a quick list there. but notice he does add, Matthew adds at the end of that list, he adds a phrase that is not in Mark or in Luke. Anybody see what that is? After honoring your father and mother. Can anybody, maybe you can't, yeah, I was going to go in the back and double check whether you could all see it without the sheets I gave you the first time. Yeah. One good eye works. Yeah. It says, make sure I say it the right language. You shall, yeah. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. So that's part of as Matthew gives it, that's part of it. It's not commandments for commandment's sake. Jesus, or Matthew rather, includes in Jesus' words here the second commandment of the Old Testament that Jesus elsewhere in Matthew's, you know, when he's asked, as he's asked in other Gospels, what's the greatest commandment? Love God, but also, Jesus says, love your neighbor. From Deuteronomy and Leviticus. So, in and around all these laws, do, don't kind of stuff, is love as the basis of it, as the reason for it. And Matthew, when he talks to this young man, adds that in. The reason I'm stressing that is that this happens more than once in Matthew, that where the other Gospels are in following the general sequence, or at least Luke's following the general sequence of Mark, Matthew throws in a word about loving your neighbor. So that for Matthew, that concept of love, not that the others wouldn't agree with this, but this is one of the main themes, ultimately, in Matthew, and one of the central pieces of what following Jesus actually means. It is to love, in that very simple term and language. You've heard the language, love is something you do. Well, yeah, but that's not the meaning of the word. It kind of goes back to the same thing. Love is the attitude of your heart. Love is what your life is about. And when that is the case, you will do. You'll do things that show it. But obviously the reason that love is something you do, language is used, is to say, well, you can't just say, I'm loving or I love you or whatever. You got to show it as well. Now, the other thing here in this story, which some of you might be able to see, is once he tells the young man obviously has a problem down deeper. And in his case, the problem is his riches. Something about them is distracting him, is holding him back. And Jesus tells him, well, go sell everything. And then what does he say to him? Anybody see it? Or is it too small? With my finger. Yeah, give it to the poor, but then something else. Which one of these buttons is the light? Not that one. Ah, there we go. I can't hold straight enough to do that, I don't think. There we go. Right in there. Anybody see it? Give to the poor and come. Follow me. Ah, does that word sound familiar? Follow me. Jesus, in other words, is offering this young man a special place. Be a follower of Jesus. That's kind of interesting to think about, because the word follow is used, again, a lot in Matthew. It's used very generally. It's used of crowds following him as he was preaching, so he went around a little further. They wanted to keep hearing, so they followed. But, you know, once Jesus left the territory, they stayed home. So it's a general term. It doesn't have to carry a lot of special meaning. But then there are the specialized group who follow Jesus, the 12 disciples. Follow me, and I'll make you fishers. That language. So that there's the specialized use of the term that actually I'm thinking about today. Or sort of the specialized sense I'm thinking about. Because there is a wider group than it would appear. And I don't know how you've thought about this, but I certainly for a long time just kind of assumed that Jesus and the 12, so 13, are going from town to town to town. But apparently there was a larger group who accompanied Jesus. How big, who knows? But one example is this. And this is said just in passing at the cross. Many women were also there looking on from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee and had provided for him Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, Joseph, and so forth. In other words, there were a number of women as well who were part of this broader group of followers. At one point in Matthew, he heals two blind men who've asked him for healing. And then he says, "Follow me." You wonder if they're in that group. We don't really know much more about it than that, but it would appear that this was kind of a larger group of folks that, you know, followers. In negative terms, in our culture, we call them hangers-on or groupies or something. But it would be that sort of thing. I want to be where he is. And somehow I have the ability to do that. And then I, you know, in terms of the finances or whatever else, so they did it. Yes, John?
How does this discussion relate to the other thing about it's harder for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven and go through an eye of the needle? How does this relate to that?
I think it's kind of a parallel case that if you... In the rich man, the eye of the needle thing is saying that there is something about riches that can draw us away in ways that, you know, we hardly even notice. And you see that in other cultures like India and places in Africa and things like that where they have so little. Often there's a freedom there. There's a lack of anxiety. They ought to be anxious as all get out. They don't have insurance. They don't have clean running water. They don't have all kinds of things. But they have these happy expressions on their face and seemingly deep down in their hearts. So
would it be harder for a wealthy Presbyterian to get to heaven?
It'd be harder for the Episcopalians, but... Yeah, we all have to look in their own hearts, right? It's obviously this is one that we in Upper St. Clair and similar environments
this is why we keep. Church.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you're going to follow Jesus, you have to keep it in perspective. And at least attempt to, right? Nobody's perfect here. That's in any of this. That's another point Matthew is going to make. I want to jump ahead because we're going to be out of time. You'll have to think about this one because, again, of the time. But following Jesus can be uncomfortable. And that also follows from what you just said. If anyone wants to become my followers, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Most of us don't end up having to go to a cross. But people in other areas of the world are. Probably more persecution of Christians in the 20th, 21st century than in all the rest of history combined. We understand. Okay, and then one quick thing back to the rich young ruler piece again. Matthew calls him young, but obviously Mark didn't. So Matthew has changed the story to make the point he wants to make to the people he's going to be talking to. So he uses it as an illustrative story more than as an actual thing that occurred in so many words. He's varied it. Why would he call him young? Anybody have a thought on that?
Early in his life.
Okay, so that means he's early. He's immature. Starting out, right? Yeah, basically, he's a learner. I'm going to skip over that one now. And that's the point Matthew's trying to make here. The disciples are learners. Really, that's the meaning of discipline, isn't it? And that root word is to learn and to grow and to develop. So basically, Matthew is showing the disciples as a learner and oftentimes, therefore, this book, when writers in Matthew try to describe it, say, you know, this is pretty much a manual for discipleship. It's intended as a guide, as a way to see in practice how others have lived and then what it means for us and how we live. And so the first basic thing is the disciples have to learn. This young man has to learn. He's already keeping commandments, but there's more to be learned because obviously he senses he's not there yet. And as a result, we find, as we look at Matthew, all kinds of places where they are shown to be learners. The Sermon on the Mount itself starts out with Jesus sitting down on a mountain. And when he does, the disciples come to him and he teaches them, it says. A teacher in ancient times, so a lot better than this, you all stood and I would be sitting. That was the normal way to teach. The teacher sat. It was a symbol of authority, actually. Just like kings sit on a throne and you stand or bow before them. You never sit next to them. You never sit at a nice conference table and have a discussion with a king. And the same applies, in a sense, to a teacher. The teacher would be seated and the others would be standing. So the disciples come up and Jesus sits himself down, takes the position of teaching, Matthew is saying, and he teaches them. Then he sends them on a training mission in chapter 10, where he sends them out to start teaching, preaching the same sorts of things that he's been teaching them to do, to give them some practice, kind of like an internship or something like that. And then you'll notice regularly the disciples are saying, "Why is this the case? Tell us what that parable means. What are you saying? Or here's an issue. What should we? How should we understand it?" They also fail regularly, as you know. On the boat in the sea, when the storm comes up, Jesus is sleeping away happily. They wake him up saying, "We're going to die, we're going to die. What are you doing sleeping?" And what's he say? "Oh, ye of little faith. Why are you worried?" "Oh, ye of little faith," in one phrase or another, happens often again in Matthew related to the disciples. We, in other words, yeah, we want to have faith. We do have faith. But boy, it doesn't always show. It doesn't come out all the time. And then, of course, they do even worse. They argue about who's the greatest, as we saw in the kingdom. No humility there. They flee at his trial, and they do a number of other things along the way in Matthew that show that, you know, they have a lot to learn. And basically their whole life, they're going to be doing that. A second thing is they serve as models, though. Matthew, it would appear, is using them to help us see, again, what our lives are all about. And his primary example of that is, of course, Simon Peter. Peter plays a bigger role in Matthew than in the other Gospels. He's significant, obviously. He's the most significant, the greatest disciple. But Matthew shows us more about him than the others tend to do. And one of those things is when he's asked, "You know, who do people say that I am?" It's Simon Peter who says, "You're the Messiah, the Son of the living God." He's the one who makes that great confession. And Jesus praises him for being able to see that and says, of course, that it's the Spirit who gave it to him, so don't be prideful about it. But Peter can do some marvelous things as a model of what a disciple is to be. And then just a few verses later, in the same conversation, Jesus turns and says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block, for you're setting your mind on not on divine things, but on human things." That's when Peter tells Jesus, "Oh, no, you're not going to go die. I mean, you know, I understand how this all works, and you're confused." And Jesus says, "No, this has got to happen, and you're creating trouble." So there's the failure model, you know, practically next to each other. So Simon Peter is the one who's able to show us exactly what it is that we tend to do in our periods of excitement and in our periods of worry. Because obviously he, after telling Jesus he's going to follow him to the end and take up his cross, if that's actually necessary, what's he do? He denies Jesus 3 times. But the basic point, then, is simply that we, like them, hopefully gradually learn to fail less and to succeed, quote, as disciples more. That over the period of our life, we grow into it more and more. It is the whole of a lifetime, though. It's not something that that we'll be able to do and be able to keep on doing easily for all of our lives. So, the kinds of words I've been using related to following Jesus are these. Do the will of the Father, hear and do the words of Jesus, practice righteousness, embrace humility, live in love. There's a nice mission statement for our lives, isn't it? how we can live. So when you see all of those, you can ask yourself, well, which of those are hardest for me? Or which are easiest? Or which do I see that I could work on because it's more relevant, to, or particularly relevant to me? Maybe now, or maybe you could look at your life generally. Are there any of those that would make sense for you personally to focus on? Maybe it's all 5 of them altogether. You know, and there's no one way for everybody. But as you do, and as you read Matthew, and look at what he says related to each other, you can look at yourself, too. We can look at ourselves and say, huh, okay, where do I do that? Or where don't I do that? And how would I do something differently if I did follow that a little more fully? That's a gigantic task, isn't it? And it really is something for a task, really, for a lifetime. And then the hardest piece, of course, as long as we're talking about love and what the implications of all this are and how deep it goes, is this other statement of Jesus that is really hard for us to put our fingers on and handle, but it also kind of will work as a lead-in to our next session. You've heard it was said, Sermon on the Mount again, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good. Love your enemy. And you, of course, then have to ask the question, who are my enemies, in order to apply this? And maybe there aren't any so specifically as somebody, you know, in the neighborhood or in the church or wherever it might be that who's really an enemy. Maybe there is. Maybe somebody at work is a real troublesome character. You read about that lots. But in any case, it could be, you can obviously take that more broadly too, because the issue is loving those who you're in some sort of enmity to. These days, I would say in the political sphere, everybody ought to be listening to that phrase from every perspective. But I'll leave that at that, you know, at this stage. Also because we're out of time. So what I want to do is mention, if you want to keep reading in Matthew, so far it hasn't detracted from attendance, that here's an assignment for you if you want to. But what I talk about next time will come primarily from there in the specifics of it. And anyway, so this last comment about loving all people basically leads into welcoming all, which is the theme for next time. So thank you all, and have a good day, have a good Sunday, have a good week, and hope to see you back next week. Thanks.
Thank you.